Welcome to Community Conversations, part of the Louisville Pride Digital Pride Initiative. I'm here today with Sonia DeVries, who is a queer activist and a grassroots organizer with Louisville Showing Up for Racial Justice, also known as LSURGE. And Sonia has been working with them since they've been around in Louisville, so about 6 or so years. Thank you for joining me today, Sonia.
Glad to be here.
So, tell me a little bit about LSURGE and what it is and what it does.
All right. Well, it's a national organization showing up for racial justice that started around the time Obama was elected, when Black and people of color leadership said, hey, we need white people to be organizing more white people into the multiracial justice movement and to be breaking white silence and organizing around anti-racism. And so we now have like over 150 chapters, and it's growing in leaps and bounds right now. So many people getting involved. So the primary focus is to organize more white people into anti-racism. LSURGE and SURGE is not a white organization, though. It's just that that work is the primary focus.
So why is it that you got involved in the organization?
Well, it actually comes back around for my original activism. When I first got involved, I grew up in an activist family. And I think when I was about 17, I got involved with my first case around the effects of racism, which was the case of Johnny Imani Harris, who was on death row, a Black man on death row, and worked with Ann Braden. And he eventually did get out. But I got involved with folks who were doing anti-racist organizing. At that time, I moved away from Louisville. Based on the request from the 70s that white people organize their own. Now, this was into the 80s, and it wasn't as popular then. What was popular in the 80s was multiracial organizing based on class, right? But so coming into SURGE made so much sense to me because, I've always felt like white people have a particular responsibility because our ancestors created white supremacy, and directly and indirectly, we have maintained it to a certain extent. And so that work makes sense to me, and I think it's necessary and, really vital to do that work, understanding that we work in conjunction with Black and brown and indigenous leaders, and we're accountable to that leadership.
As you say, that has not always been the dominant view. There's been skepticism about sort of white anti-racist organizations in the past.
For good reason.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of that?
Gosh, I mean, it's so complex, but it's like, that's why I think the accountability part is so important, because, for so many reasons, but also because, what we need to be listening to is what the most affected communities are asking for and demanding and wanting to focus on, which doesn't mean that we don't come up with like stuff that we want to do. But it has to be in conjunction and in alignment. And I think anytime you get white folks organizing without that kind of accountability, you often have problems. I mean, it's like we only have to look at the white-dominated women's movement to see that, the way that a lot of obliviousness to race and class and, same was true. Like, I never got directly involved with the mainstream LGBT, at the time it was LGBT, movement. Because, I remember in San Francisco when the demands were to be included in the military and to be able to get married. And I was like, that's just not my idea of a revolution, to be able to fight in imperialist racist wars and to be able to, mimic heterosexual relationships. I understand it's very important to have marriage equality, though. I did get convinced of that, at least. I'll never get married, but...
Well, and whether it's the most important thing to be fighting for, when you know, and that's a question, yeah. You know, in different areas, of course, marriage equality is settled, at least for now, but people right. were pushing for that. And it's, you know, do we even have hate crimes protection? And do we have hate crimes protection that covers gender identity as well as sexual orientation? And there's a lot right. of tactical questions, strategic questions about, you know, what cause do we fight for? And that's, right. I think that speaks to that accountability piece.
Yes, yes. And when you have a white-led movement, you get statements like, why would we focus on police abuse? Right? Mm-hmm. Not recognizing who is part of the larger community, that it's not just white, middle, and upper-class people, but people tend to get that kind of tunnel vision and not recognize the privilege involved in just fighting for marriage equality or just fighting to be part of the military.
One of the things you just mentioned was police abuse, which obviously is central to this racial uprising that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Mayor Fisher agreed to almost immediately when the protesting began was a civilian review board with subpoena power, which is something that's been a goal of anti-racist and anti-police abuse organizing in Louisville for at least 20 years, at least as long as I know about. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to make a difference?
Well, it remains to be seen. Like, that is not an active thing yet. There's, you know, a committee, I guess, to talk about it. And unfortunately, a lot of times these announcements get made and then what actually happens is very different. So we have to keep pushing on that to make sure, because I have been in cities where they have civilian review boards that basically work alongside the police. So we need to be really, really vigilant about how that plays out, how it unfolds, and keep making the demands that we're making. You know, one of the things I've been excited about is that this is, it's so much bigger than police abuse. You know, it's about the entire system. And I think COVID-19 has really brought out, you know, the just brutal inequality in our society, you know, and the fact that, sure, everybody's susceptible to COVID-19. Well, of course, if you have underlying conditions, more so. But the death rate of Black people and Indigenous people, especially, is so much higher. And, you know, and it just, and so it brings in all of the issues, the inequality in healthcare and housing and absolutely everything. And at the same time, you know, we have these just devastating examples of police brutality, you know, here in Louisville and all over the United States and actually all over the world. People are fighting against white supremacy. People are like, we've had it. We are getting rid of this now. And I feel like it's a much more all-encompassing movement right now. It's like, no, we're not talking about police reform. We are talking about abolition. We're talking about defunding the police. We're talking about reallocating resources. We're talking about alternatives, you know, like the police should not be going to deal with someone who's having a mental health crisis. What ends up happening? They often end up dead. The rate of people with mental and emotional issues going on who are killed by the police is so high, you know? And I think all of this is being recognized, that it's about the economic structure, the political structure. I mean, the Charles Booker's campaign, I think also like showed us that Kentucky is ready for like some real transformational change. You know, you have this amazing visionary young Black man traveling all across Kentucky and getting this support, you know, in majority white communities sometimes. It's like, to me, that is so hopeful. It's like people are really wanting real change, you know. And, you know, the work around getting justice for Breonna continues, you know, and it's so much bigger, you know, that story is so important in and of itself and represents so much. And it's like, I heard her mother talking about, I'll try not to get emotional, but I heard her mother talking about how her daughter, Breonna, always said she wanted to be part of making big change. Mm. And that she's realizing, you know, this was not the way they had envisioned it, but that this is what's happening.
It would be amazing to be in a world where we didn't need martyrs to make these big changes, but it keeps coming up. That's kind of the moments that trigger things and yes. crystallize things in people's minds. And it would be great if it didn't require that, because police abuse and racism were just as wrong and bad when Breonna Taylor and George Floyd were alive than as they are now.
Right.
But right. I want to ask you about, and this, we kind of started talking about this a little bit, but there's one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is, in my mind, I call it the paradox of white leadership. Mm-hmm. And it's something I see in a lot of the conversations around anti-racist organizing, is white people need to take leadership. They need to organize their own people. They need to be proactive, not be asking people of color what to do, mm-hmm. Looking to them for direction. But at the same time, they need to follow the direction of people of color. And, mm-hmm. And I think there's a paradox there. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced that? Have you resolved that paradox for yourself?
Yeah, I think that's why I like the framing of accountability partners instead, because it's not about sitting there on our hands, okay, what should we do next? it's about really listening and paying attention and, coming up also, supporting campaigns, but also coming up with what we think makes sense in terms of a particular moment, and just staying in conversation. I think it's super important that it's not about being passive and like, okay, I'm gonna wait until, so-and-so tells me what to do here. Cause that would be a huge burden, huge burden. And we don't want to do that. Yeah, like I said, being accountable, paying attention, doing our work. And I just feel so excited that we have this amazing leadership, like all across the country. A lot of queer Black women, Indigenous women, Latinx, it's just like amazing leadership developing all over the place and all these different groups and projects. And, it's funny because someone said to me the other day, yeah, but we should all be united. We should all be one. And I'm like, actually, I think this is exciting, and yes, there's, definitely we want to develop that communication and cooperation between groups, but I'm excited when something pops up across town that I didn't know about and I had nothing to do with, it's like, yay, this is great. There's just a lot of spontaneous, really creative work going on.
It's that feeling of going to a meeting and not knowing everybody in the room. It's like, yes. Oh, wow.
Yes. I have been to actions recently where I'm like, wow, I don't recognize anybody. Mm-hmm. And that is fantastic. The rising of young leaders is really, really wonderful. There's so many young people getting involved and so many young people of color and young Black people. And it's just like, and young queer people, it's a very exciting time, and I've been saying repeatedly, like, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I've been involved for a long time. And I was thinking, I wonder if everybody says this though. And then I heard Angela Davis speak and she said, I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. And I thought, okay, I'm not imagining this. This is huge,
It definitely seems, definitely feels and is, clearly different. And I think, one of the things I've noticed is, of course, so many more young people of all races are aware and engaged and, mm-hmm. young white people talking about anti-racism, which was a difficult concept to get across to people, or was more difficult to get across a few years ago. But also seeing people I know who are my age or older, who I've never thought of as being particularly political, being very outspoken on these. And so, and some people I used to work with and don't really know, I've seen, really being out there on this. And I'm thinking, it's interesting that you've had some kind of arc or, that's not the position I necessarily would have expected them to take when I worked with them 10 years ago. And so I think people have really changed.
Yeah. That is so true. You know, I was talking with, I did a workshop the other day on communicating, having difficult conversations about racism. And this man who was probably close to 70 came and he said he had never been an activist before. And that what moved him was this moment, but also remembering something that happened 30 years ago where he felt like he did not do the right thing in terms of a black coworker who tried to, you know, make him aware of racism in the workplace. And I was so moved by that, you know, and that's happening across the board. And, you know, the people who've been doing the work all along, it's like that is the groundwork for some of this. It's like in the first rallies when I would hear the you know, young black leaders say, hey, we need white people in the front. There wasn't any hesitation. We need white people in the front, you know, to make a barrier with the police because you're less likely to be harmed. I don't know if 10 years ago white folks would have just gone right up there in the front. You know what I mean? Because there wasn't that understanding. And so I just think there's a much deeper understanding. We still have, you know, a long way to go. And we still need to keep learning. We need to be humble about it. And that's one thing, you know, one thing I'm always telling new activists, especially new white activists, is don't just read the stuff on the internet. Like, read the history, read, you know, James Baldwin, read Angela Davis, read Asada Shakur. It's Asada Shakur's birthday today, by the way. And she is still living free in Cuba, and she inspires people to this day. You know, that we need to keep doing that. I mean, I myself stay engaged with you know, reading and discussions because, you know, every day in this society, we are inundated with white supremacy, with patriarchy, with, you know, homophobia, transphobia, all of it. And you can't just sit still because it's like a sickness coming into us, you know? And so I really feel strongly about that, you know, and just all of it, not just the theory, not just the history, but the literature, the poetry. And it's, you know, it's sustaining. That's some of the stuff that sustains me in harder moments. It reminds me why I'm here.
And I want to talk about, you mentioned difficult conversations, and, you know, that's a really big part of this. I think that what changes is when people change, and people change when they can have a relationship with somebody who can help them along. And that's very difficult. But I think that's really where white people can really make a difference, is because we can have different conversations with other white people than people of color can. So I'm assuming you've probably had some of those conversations. Can you talk a little bit about that and how people can do that, you know, without shutting somebody down?
And yes, thank you for bringing that up, because that is actually one of the things that was very attractive to me about Surge, was the idea that in trying to welcome more white people into anti-racism, we strive to call people in instead of calling out. I came from a calling out culture. Let me just give you a very short example of when I was, you know, in my early 20s, and I was with I won't say the organization. I was with somebody who was selling an anti-racist paper, a white person. And, you know, this nice family, white family, was walking down the street, and she said, would you like to buy this anti-racist paper? And he said, oh, no, thank you. And she just turned on him, and she was like, what are you, a racist or something? That's an extreme example of calling out.
And did he in fact buy the paper after that?
No, he didn't. Of course he didn't. He probably didn't come anywhere near us ever again. It's not a good way to organize people, you know, and I try to remember that. It's like we grow up in this culture, which I think is, you know, very much influenced by white supremacy and patriarchy and all that, all those systems of oppression, where it's more important to be right and prove your point than it is to have real communication. But it's real communication that helps people be open to change. You know, I've gotten a great practice with LSURGE in door knocking, because we've gone out and we've talked to total strangers about police brutality, about immigration, about the schools, all this stuff. You don't know who's on the other end of the door. And so you learn to really listen instead of just, you know, giving your spiel. You learn to listen to where that person's coming from and ask questions. And it's not about being nice. It's not about standing up and showing up and, you know, being actively anti-racist. It's about, like, what is the point? The point is to engage more people. The point is to recognize each other's humanity. And, you know, I have seen people. I mean, I remember knocking on the door of a woman who was in her 50s, a white woman. And we stood there and we talked about racism. And at the end, she got kind of teary. And she said, "This is the first time I've ever had this conversation." You know? You know, and I mentioned when we were chatting before this about my grandmother, she embodied those values of Surge. You know, she was this fierce woman who was living in Holland during the Nazi occupation. And my grandfather was in a concentration camp and all this stuff, you know. And so she had to deal with the SS soldiers coming to her door. And she was always very fierce. She would not give them any information. She would stand up to them. But one thing she shared with me, she said, "But I never tried to degrade or humiliate people in conversation," she said, "because I just felt like we would be acting like them if we did that." And she said, "And these soldiers, a lot of them are in the military against their will. Their families would be killed if they refused." And so she recognized that ability to show up and be really strong and really fierce in the face of power. But also, you know, just a certain way of communicating and treating people, you know, and the calling in. We don't call in, you know, people like the police. That's not no, we're calling in people we're trying to organize to anti-racism, right?
I think that that's an amazing story. I think that speaks to the difference between kindness and niceness. You know, you don't just have, like, nice is the kind of, you know, we're not going to ruffle any feathers. And you can be, you know, you can hold somebody accountable. You can be very tough with them, but still be kind, you know, and sometimes that is the kind thing to do.
Yes. And people get really confused about that. They think calling in is about being nice and that it's part of, like, middle class white culture. And it's like, no, that's not what we're going for.
One of my big pet peeves is this fascination with punching Nazis that people love to talk about, as if that's anything that's going to be effective, or that it comes up very often, you know, like somehow this is what we need to go out and do is find Nazis and punch them.
Right.
And it's like, you know, then and Nazis are a problem, of course, but I think the bigger problem is the 40 million Americans that, you know, don't see a problem with what's going on in our country, that they're not, you know, they're not going to go to a Nazi rally, but they're going to vote for people or support policies that enable all these things. And we can't go punch all those people in the face until they agree with us.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up a really important point and one that we could probably spend an hour talking about. But, you know, and it's so, yeah, I understand the impulse. I do. Just like I understand why someone wants to throw a rock through a bank. I would like to throw a rock through a bank, but I don't. Because it might harm the people who are standing next to me more than it harms the bank. And because it's just not, you know, I don't consider it really great strategy, but I would never condemn anybody for doing it. Let me just say that. So I understand that impulse, but you're right. It doesn't really change anything. It's certainly not going to make that person go, "Huh, yeah, maybe I was wrong about the way I was thinking." You know, I once, when I was also in my early 20s, there was what they called the white Woodstock, white Aryan Woodstock, something like that. I don't know. It was in California, of all places, right, where white supremacy is very strong outside of San Francisco. And the police were there with their weapons pointed on us, of course, the anti-racists, multiracial grouping. And when I was walking back, I saw a group of white men beating to a pulp another white man, and I didn't know who was who. You know what I mean? I found out later it was anti-racists beating up this very skinny little white Nazi who was probably 18 at most. And You know, I remembered my grandmother, and I just thought, no, no, that's not what we want to be doing, you know?
I want to wrap up today by you know, we talk about how tough this is. People talk about who they've cut out of their lives or they've lost relationships because they speak up about racism. But what positives has being involved in this work brought to you personally?
I love that question. And can I just add something to what I just said?
Well, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I am talking about white anti-racist organizers when I say what I said. You know, I would never try to police anything anybody else does. I don't, you know, because there's so much pain and so much anger. You know, somebody from the media tried to get me to condemn certain actions that were happening. And I just said, no, absolutely not. Let's condemn police brutality. You know, so that's how I feel about that. But the positives, oh my God, the positives. You know, I was sitting with one of the amazing Black women who is part of the leadership of what's going on in this city, Shamika Parrish, the other morning about 4 a.m. in front of the jail waiting for people to get out. And there was just this community of folks sitting around who were all totally committed to just being there of support. And there was this young Black man who was dancing in the middle of the street in front of the light of the jail. And there was something about that moment, I don't think I can articulate it, that was so beautiful. And it's part of what I'm seeing is this like empowerment. People who have been, you know, locked out and kind of just like, no, this is our city. These are our streets, you know, and that's beautiful. And the people that you meet in this work, that is, I think, one of, there's a poem or a song that came out of the civil rights movement. I think Sweet Honey in the Rock sings it. And it's about like part of this work is about the people that I've met and march alongside and come to know. And, you know, we live in an incredibly segregated society, segregated along all lines. And when you're part of the movement and you know, in the long term, your relationships change. And I don't give it up for anything. You know, it is amazing. And the generosity of the larger community, the people who can't be in the streets for whatever reason, is also just so moving. You know, it's bringing out you know, those qualities in people that we want to see. You know, you know, my grandmother going through that, you know, that hell of Nazi occupation, she still would say, you know, I believe the majority of people want justice. And I believe the majority of people are good. And, you know, some people would say that's naive. It's what I see, you know, it's what I see when we knock on people's doors. It's what I'm seeing in the streets. Those in power are minority. You know, we are the majority, and we're not going to stop. You know, and it is a joyful thing. There's a lot of grief. There's a lot of rage. There's a lot of joy.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Sonia, to talk about these very important issues. Before we go, can you tell people how they can get involved in LSURG?
Yes. You can look us up on Facebook. There's a Louisville Showing Up for Racial Justice discussion page, which anybody can, you know, communicate on. The email address is slipping my mind. also, I'm doing a workshop with one of the national surge leaders, Z, next Thursday on having difficult conversations about racism. So I don't know if you have, is there a chat or something you can put my email?
People can find? we'll put it on there. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. And just, you know, keep looking at all the different pages that you want, you know, to find out what's going on. Look at LSURG, No Justice, No Peace, Kentucky Lions, BLM, you know, there's so much going on, and get involved, find where you can put your strengths and your passion so that it will be sustainable.
Awesome.
Well, thank you for the long haul.
Thank you for joining me, and thank you for all the work that you
do. Thank you. Yeah.